Hey listeners, my fabulous colleagues Amy Bernstein and Amy Gallo are back with a new season of Women at Work. You know, it's your guide to whatever you're facing at work, from anxiety to Gen AI. Listen to new episodes of Women at Work every Monday, wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to the HBR IdeaCast from Harvard Business Review. I'm Sarah Green. I'm talking today with Harvard Business School professor Siddhal Neely, an expert on communication and global teams. Siddhal, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
So I thought we would just start by talking about some of the challenges faced by managers of globally distributed teams, and maybe how some of those challenges are different from, you know, maybe the challenges faced by any team that's maybe like a virtual team or sort of distributed. What are the sort of special challenges for globally distributed teams?
It's interesting because anytime you have dispersion, which means that you have members of a collaboration who are not co-located having to work together, you have a layer of complexity that these collaborators need to contend with. And then you overlay this global component and you have what you just named as globally distributed work or globally distributed teams and some of the boundaries that they have to manage extremely well in order to be effective include time zone differences. How do you make sure that you're able to engage one another in a way that doesn't inconvenience one member or one group more than the other? And how do you make sure that you're constantly on the same line, even though the time zone differences could be so vast that you have very little overlapping time from which to coordinate work? There are differences around norms. There are differences around practices. There are differences, of course, around language. There's differences around culture. There are differences around local markets that they have to bridge. And oftentimes, and the thing that gets in the way for most globally distributed team members is that they don't know what they don't know. What I mean by that is they often don't realize that another member of the global team or the globally distributed team is interpreting something in the wrong way, that that member may not have the proper context by which to make decisions or even to assess what's going on. There's a ton of blind spots. And so these teams need to develop a very strong mutual adaptation process in order to work successfully and ultimately deliver the types of results that they're put together to deliver.
So in that mutual adaptation process, what does that involve?
It involves a number of things. One is people have to show up with the mindset that they have to constantly learn and that they have to constantly teach about where they are and about their perspectives. And what I mean by that is that people have to be in a position to always teach their collaborators and also learn from their collaborators, not only about the work that they're engaged in, but also the process by which work is done. That's one. Another aspect of this mutual adaptation is to always be in a position where you're constantly communicating about the basics of your relationship and constantly evaluating the social dynamics of your relationship. Where am I? Where's the other person? Okay, let me put myself in the shoes of the other and really learn about their position and why, in fact, they're making these decisions. Let me try to understand the temporal dimensions of my collaborators. That could mean just how people treat time worldwide, very, very different. So there's this constant need to teach, learn, suspend judgment, and communicate in order to make it work. You know, I think of this as almost like a marriage or an important relationship where you have partners who have to constantly communicate in order to make things cohere in the right way.
It's interesting. When you said it was like a marriage, a lot of heads, my head started nodding. My sound producer here started nodding. I was like, yeah, that is what it sounds like. And actually, that kind of makes me wonder, how much are some of these things that teams need to do, things that kind of any team in one office working together in one country would need to do? And is it just accentuated and it becomes even more critical in a globally dispersed team? Or are some of these things actually different?
Great question. Some things are very much accentuated. Some things are different. And the way you lead one of these globally distributed teams are definitely different. I mean, granted, you're doing all of the traditional elements of managing people, whether thinking about the composition of your team, thinking about the process by which you communicate and interact, thinking about the culture or the norms of the teams, you have to do that. But you also have to do a number of things that are very different in globally distributed teams. For example, we know that globally distributed teams are not meeting face-to-face, are not syncing on a regular basis, and in fact may not even have the opportunity to meet face-to-face for an entire year, if not more. And so the leader has to ensure that the aspects of any face-to-face contact are recreated virtually. Spontaneous communication needs to exist pretty regularly. How do you do that when people don't meet face-to-face? Well, the way you do that is you implement it as part of your regular communication, your formal communication. You create space for people to engage spontaneously while you have your formal meetings. I call this structuring unstructured time. Very different than your classical teams. And so it becomes then very important to create these elements from a virtual way such that people have access to one another in a spontaneous way, such that people have the room and the opportunity to disclose what they're thinking, what they're feeling, such that people are constantly remembering their collaborators in other countries and remembering their constraints regularly.
So when you talk about structuring unstructured time in that way, is there like maybe an example that would really bring this home?
An example of structuring unstructured time is when a global team leader sets aside 6 to 7 minutes at the beginning of a regular conference call with his or her team to check in with people. Some people label it as our shared time, where people can just talk about what's happening to them personally, what's happening to them at the workforce, wins, successes, etc. In order for this to really work, leaders have to model this, so they have to bring in their own stories, their own scenarios, in order to encourage other people to do the same. This is particularly important when you're in a cross-cultural situation where people are not accustomed to bringing these types of unstructured conversation in a formal meeting period. That's an example of this. You know, we've looked at structured, unstructured time in teams, and we've looked at teams that don't hold the structured, unstructured time. And there's a material difference in the cohesion of the team with the unstructured, structured time. There's a clear difference with their performance, and there's a clear difference with their ability to work together in the long term when you create that space. So in a sense, when I talk about structuring unstructured time, it may feel very inefficient to spend 6, 7, or 8 minutes in a one-hour meeting doing this conversation. But at the end of the day, it really buys improved work relationships, improved work results, and can be extremely efficient.
That's so interesting. So shifting slightly to focus more on the communication aspects of this itself, I know sometimes I worry at HBR and another business media that when we're talking about communicating across cultures, I worry sometimes that focusing so much on the differences between people, we're sort of stereotyping people, or, you know, how do you sort of strike the balance between being respectful of potential differences, but not really making assumptions about someone just because they come from a different country or different culture?
That's a great question. It's interesting because what I'm witnessing with global teams or globally distributed teams or any types of collaborations that are extending across geographies, what I'm witnessing is that the members of these settings are so multicultural that it becomes difficult for individuals to behave in ways that are stereotypical. For example, no longer do you have teams with five Americans, three Germans, and four Japanese employees. You may have a team or a group having a conversation, 15 people that are representing 10 countries. And so it becomes then important to develop cultural intelligence not on the specific stereotypical countries, the do's and don'ts that people imagine that they need to follow for particular countries, but it becomes even more important to have a strategy on how do I communicate and learn from others who are from other countries. It's not about the do's and don'ts. It's about how do I make sure at the intersection of both of our conversation, communication, at the intersection of the engagement of other people, how do we make sure that we create a moment where we understand each other fully, where we communicate fully, and we drop this belief of pinning certain stereotypical attributions about people. So if you have a group communicating and it's a group from 10 countries, it's impossible to do the stereotyping. You have to slow yourself down and think really hard on how to make sure that everyone in that group understands you and you understand everyone in that group. Inquiry is important. Advocacy is important. Listening is important. And listening more than talking is even that much more important because there's a lot to discern in order to be productive in that context.
Mm. Well, and speaking of understanding a group of people from 10 different countries, I know you've done a lot of work on global teams using English as a kind of common language.
Right.
I guess tell us a little bit about your thinking on that topic and kind of why English seems to be the way to go.
It's interesting because I have been looking at this phenomenon for a very, very long time, well over a decade. And the reason I became interested in it is because it's out in the world. So in a sense, I'm documenting what's happening out in the world and trying to bring it to the forefront for companies to make sure that they're thinking very carefully about their language strategy that today involves a very diverse workforce. The reality is that English has become the preeminent business language of the world, period. And for that reason, you have millions of people around the world who are working hard to migrate to this business language in order to communicate with their colleagues in country, outside of country, etc. And so my argument has been for the last decade or so that we need to be aware of this. We need to make sure that we harness people's abilities to engage one another quite well and that we understand what it means to have people who have fluency in English, communicate with others who don't have fluency in English. You have to empower and train people. And at the end of the day, we also need to make sure that everyone in a global communication setting has the sensitivities and the right behaviors to ensure that every member of that team or that group can strive. That's the reason I've been very interested in this. And I think it's starting to really make a difference. Major corporations are thinking very hard about their language strategy as they're thinking about their global strategy. What's more fundamental than communication? What is more fundamental than language to enable communication? And so this is the reason I've been really interested in it, and this is the reason why companies are becoming very interested in developing their strategies around this.
Well, and it seems, and I think you're sort of starting to speak to some of this, it seems important that if a company is going to say, okay, we're just admitting that most of the time we communicate in English and that's going to be your lingua franca, that they have some kind of talent development or policies in place so that the non-native speakers aren't becoming kind of second-class citizens in the organization.
I think that's exactly right. And at the same time, it also is important for the organization as a whole in terms of knowledge development, knowledge sharing in terms of ensuring that English native speakers are trained to communicate with those who are not fluent in their language. There are so many dimensions to consider when thinking about a language strategy, but the one that you mentioned is critical. Those who don't have the fluency need to be supported fully so that you get the best from your talent pool. There was one person who really stood out to me at a very large German software company a very long time ago, and I never really forgot him because he had a PhD in computer engineering and it was one of their super engineers, very competent, had a long history in the company, and the company at the time that I spoke with him had just decided to make English its business language, and this would affect thousands of German nationals at the time. And he said, you know, when I communicate in English, I feel like a child. And I don't say as much as I need to. I don't argue. I find myself shrinking. Here you have this incredibly competent person. They call a super engineer. They're so proud to have him at this company. And as soon as they change languages, he feels like he's a child. Childlike, and has begun, at that point, had begun to withdraw. That's the kind of thing that we're trying to counter with the language strategy conversation.
I think that's great. Yeah, I think we've all probably, if we've traveled to a country where we don't speak the language, had some kind of feeling of like, there's just a lot of cognitive activity happening when you don't speak the language.
Yeah.
So I think that's really important.
And one more thing with this is that if you don't give people the type of support to harness their talent, to harness everything they bring to the table, you create a culture in which some people are included, others are excluded. You create an environment where there's some people who speak the most, but they may not be the most talented.
Well, and that's, I think, you know, important for any manager to think about.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Well, Siddall, I do feel like we're just starting to scratch the surface here, but at the same time, I know we're running out of time. Thank you so much for talking with us today.
Thank you so much, Sarah.
That was Harvard Business School professor Siddall Neely. She has a couple of HBR articles on developing a language strategy at multinational companies. If you want more information on that, I definitely recommend checking them out. For those and for more on managing global teams, visit hbr.org.